Mr. Cato?
Thank you.
Mr. Cato?
Yes, sir.
Ready to start?
Yes.
Good. Committee will come to order. Good morning. This is the Customer Service Operations and Safety Committee meeting for Thursday, December 17th, 2009, last of the year. We have before us an agenda that's been previously distributed. Are there any changes to the agenda? If not, the unanimous consent will accept the agenda as presented. Hearing no objection, the agenda is approved. Also before us, the minutes of the November 19th meeting. There was a correction made. Initial minutes distributed were in error. We have a blue copy. That should be the right one. Anybody have any additional corrections or questions about the minutes? If not, if there's no objection, we will accept the minutes as presented. Hearing no objection, by unanimous consent, the minutes are accepted as presented in their amended form. Which brings us to our regular agenda. I'll turn first to Mr. Cato.
Thank you, Chairman Zimmerman. In recent months since the June 22nd accident, there's been much discussion at Metro, in the media, and on Capitol Hill, and on our community, within our community, questioning the safety of the Metro system and this agency's commitment to running the safest transit operations possible. To win the trust of our customers, employees, and others, we have a battle in front of us, the proportions of which have never been confronted here before. Until now, these battles involve not only the Metro system, but every person in every corner of our nation who plays a role in operating any kind of transit service. We must, and we will, do everything we can to protect our riders, to restore their confidence in mass transit, and to prevent or to remove all barriers, including resources, from implementing and our efforts to run the safest possible system. If people don't feel safe, we want to have riders. There can be no doubt in their mind about safety, period. Statistically, mass transit remains the safest mode of transportation above automobiles and airplanes. However, in every mode, in every workplace, in every aspect of our lives, the threat of accidents is always there. But we must take every effort to avoid them. I, along with every Metro employee, would do whatever is necessary to minimize that risk. This is not lip service. This is my declaration of war. War on everything and anything that stands in our way of making our system as safe as it can possibly be. Today it's about action, not about reviews, not about discussion, and not about planning on doing something. We have a plan, and we've already started making changes in how we do business. Moving forward, this agency is only about action and implementation. From hiring to training, from procedures to operations, from leadership to frontline employees, every person and every aspect of our organization will be affected. These changes will come with accountability for everyone, since it takes everyone to make Metro the safest system possible. However, no one is more accountable than I. The responsibility for protecting riders is Metro's cornerstone and will guide everything we do. Changes will not be instant. It will be a process. However, next week will be better than this week, and things will transform and improve every day. Some actions have already been taken. Major organizational changes have been implemented, and I will not hesitate in the future if I think we're not heading in the right direction of making additional changes. We are working with our union partners to enhance safety task force at every location. We will expand our safety training program with the involvement and support of the National Transit Institute of Rutgers University and the Transportation Safety Institute, an arm of the U.S. Department of Transportation. While we have resolved many of the issues listed in past TARC and Federal Transit Administration safety audits, I am not satisfied with the progress and have directed our staff to complete all open items in the coming weeks. This week, Congress approved $150 million in capital funding for Metro. We expect the President to sign the bill next week. Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia have committed their share of $50 million each, which will provide $300 million for needed capital equipment and safety repairs. Early in the beginning of the year, I will bring to the Board procurement actions for rail cars, which will begin the replacement of the 1000 series cars. In addition, we will have funding to enact other safety recommendations from the National Transportation Safety Board and other capital upgrades to improve safety and reliable service. Let me address a critical component of implementing these actions: resources. Yes, Metro is in what might be the worst financial crisis of our existence, but as I have said earlier, nothing, not even resources, will hinder our efforts to make this system as safe as possible. This action plan is going to require more resources. I am prepared to shift current resources to fulfill our safety commitment. I will also say that this shifting of resources may result in some changes, and some significant, in how we do business. But please keep in mind, if riders don't feel safe, we won't have the need for the service. Finally, I'd like to tell you how we're implementing this action plan. Everyone at Metro has a role. We will ensure our employees are committed to safety by making them accountable through performance. I have also had discussions with Local 689 President Jackie Jeter, who will be at the Board meeting with us today. While we have our differences, we firmly are united in our common belief that the most important Metro goal is safety. Safety of our customers, our riders, and safety of our employees. Union members have pledged their commitment to accomplish this goal. We will also be working in partnership with the Federal Transit Administration and the Tri-State Oversight Committee to achieve these goals. Both agencies have offered access to resources to help us carry out these tasks. Yesterday, I provided to you a new memorandum of understanding regarding the Tri-State Oversight Committee that was agreed to between the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia. I fully support their initiatives. We will fully support and work with the Tri-State Oversight Committee, the Federal Transit Administration, and other entities in their role of providing important safety oversight. As I've said before, I welcome stronger safety oversight and recommendations. This week, I've been engaged in the Federal Transit Administration triannual audit and have come away with a clear understanding of what we must do to make substantial, real changes in this organization. The audit findings and the final comprehensive report will clearly articulate what we are faced with and what we must do to make Metro the safest system possible. This will be substantial work. While the report's recommendations will be implemented, we're not waiting for the report to take action and to move forward. We look forward to working more closely with the Federal Transit Administration and the Tri-State Oversight Board. On February 14th, I will be updating the Board on the progress of the action implementation. I will address what we've done today, associate results, as well as next steps. Again, I appreciate your support and as we continue to work to make the Metro system as safe as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Cato. Any questions for Mr. Cato at this time? If not, we will appropriately move to item A, which of course is the safety report. I believe Chief Taborn is going to be presenting that this morning, Mr. Cato.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Chief.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, other committee members. What I wanted to follow on with respect to General Manager Cato's comments is that starting Monday, the Federal Transit Administration conducted an audit of the Tri-State Oversight Committee, and they are here on site today. In fact, they will be closing out the audit this afternoon. We will get the actual report in sometimes in February. But the audit, the scope of that audit was to look at the oversight relationships with the Tri-State Oversight Committee and WMATA, to look at the outstanding findings from the 2007 audit, to look at the TOC and WMATA oversight process, to look at WMATA's implementation of the internal safety audit program and to look at TOX and WMATA's communications. And again, that report will be final in February. We also, as you well know, the West Falls Church incident that happened November 29th on a Sunday morning that involved a stationary six-car train colliding with another six-car train. Three employees received non-life-threatening injuries. The National Transit Safety Board has begun that investigation, and again, we will provide you information when available from them. If we can go to, this is an initiative, the safety initiative that sort of addresses some of the concerns with the track worker protection. And it's ProTram, a signaling device that are being currently tested on the trains now. And that test should be completed within the next 3 months, and we'll look at the analysis of that test and decide as to whether or not we need to consider purchasing these devices. Next slide. Another safety initiative involving bus is the award of cameras for the buses in that system. In bus maintenance contract, to maintain bus cameras has increased the reliability close to 80%, and the contract would be awarded fully in 2010 to equip additional buses with cameras which will assist in safety and security operations. The Metro bus fleet currently has an existing fleet size of 1,480 buses, and 856 of these are already equipped with those closed-circuit cameras. Next slide. Metro Access, a local safety committee, has recently been developed with representation from Metro Access facilities across the region. And due to a higher number of incidents related to customers acting independently of the driver, the importance of following prescribed Metro Access safety procedures, including remaining in a seatbelt throughout the trip, allowing the driver to assist in entering and exiting the vehicle and accepting appropriate passenger assistance through the door-to-door process, is in place. Next slide. What you will see now are some of the appendixes that sort of reflect the types of injuries that have happened. The first category are those of rail passengers' injuries on board, and you can see that between from 2008 to 2009, there has been an increase of 33 of those such injuries. We also reflect from January to November the rail fatalities. In 2008, we didn't have any, and unfortunately in 2009, we experienced 11 rail fatalities. We also have identified rail fatalities that address suicides. In 2008, we had two of those, and in 2006, we have experienced six of those such fatalities at a variety of different Metro Rail stations. We have 167 occupant injuries, and that sort of addresses within the stations and the parking lots, and we've experienced only 76 of those so far this year, a reduction of 91. And we sort of address the passenger rate, and this is based upon a million miles, if I'm not mistaken, a million miles. Derailments on the main line in 2008, we had one. To date, this year, we've had two. Fire incidents, we've had 45 in 2008 and 55 in 2009. And we've had a series of similar types of smoke incidents, totaling about 84 this year. Next slide. Okay, bus passengers' injuries in 2008, 144, 105 so far, and that's been a great reduction of 39 in 2009. Pedestrian injuries, we've had three so far this year compared to none last year, and fatalities, we've experienced one this year. Collision rate is also reflected from 2008 to 2009. We've reduced by 1.35. Next slide.
Relative to metro access safety performance, there has been a considerable number of riders increase in metro access. In 2008, however, we had 66 passenger injuries, and we've increased to 103 in 2009, which is an additional 37 such activities. Metro access collision rate had a plus 0.02 increase from 2009 to 2008. And the metro access passenger rate has increased by 0.08%. And this is how the performance indicators are tracked: passenger injury rate, incidence time 1 million passenger miles, and N equals the number of injuries. Preventable accidents is defined as an accident that occurred because the employee failed to do everything reasonably expected of a trained professional to board. And non-preventable is those accidents that occur despite every reasonable action. And the service miles are the miles that vehicles are scheduled will actually travel while in service vehicles. And that concludes the presentation.
Questions, Jim Collins?
Chief, go back to the metro access chart, if you could. You know, I understand the increase of passengers being carried, also the fact that you know, you could expect some increase, although we don't like to see it. But what's concerning me is the rate has gone up, too, and that indicates an average rate. So I'm a little concerned about that trend, and also the collisions and the safety program. Is our contractor aggressively pursuing safety training for the drivers? What is the trend, or what's the cause of some of the accidents? In fact, if there are collisions, are drivers being ticketed? Can you give me some numbers and statistics on that, please?
If I could defer to Kristen Kent or Celine.
Good morning. I'm going to ask our Director of Metro Access, Celine Dalton Cummins, to respond to your questions.
I first wanted to address the rising injury rate, obviously, as you noted. And as Chief Taborn previously mentioned, one of the things that we're focusing on right now is a customer communication campaign, because a number of the injuries that we're seeing are related to customers going against the advice of the driver or the policies of the program and boarding the vehicle or alighting the vehicle independently instead of accepting assistance and being injured in that process, or undoing their seatbelts during a metro access trip, the vehicle's already in motion. And things like that, or as the vehicle is approaching their home, let's say, or their place of business, they will begin exiting the building prior to the vehicle stopping, parking, and the driver providing door-to-door assistance. So although obviously it's, you know, free will and customers will do what they will do, we're trying to impart to them and remind them of the importance of the passenger assistance that we do provide and the safety procedures that we have in place and following those procedures. Regarding the training of the Metro Access drivers, safety is always paramount with all of our training, but one of the things that our primary contractor, MB Transportation, is working on right now is launching a new, more interactive training program for new drivers, as well as all their refresher training, to focus on training models that work better for adult learners and have more interplay between the trainers and the drivers. And I believe that that's going to improve the entirety of the Metro Access training program and significantly the engagement on the safety elements and the passenger assistance elements that are so essential to our service. I think that will address it strongly.
You know, what I'm hearing you say is that it's the passenger's fault. And I'm not sure I'm buying that, because clearly the report is being given by the driver, I'm assuming. Are we, in fact, investigating these to find out the other side of the story, if, in fact, the driver is accusing the passenger of being not careful?
Well, yes, we are. And very frequently we have reports, you know, when a passenger falls down, even if they say that they're not injured, obviously we go through steps with road supervisors to question them a little bit further to get the details of the incident. And very frequently on the scene, the passenger will straightforwardly tell the road supervisor, it's not a matter of driver accusing, but tell the road supervisor, here's what I did, here's what happened, but I'm fine, you know, and then sign a waiver saying that they don't need medical transportation. So it's very frequently the passenger actually indicating directly to the investigator on the scene what happened and that the driver wasn't at fault. And I'm not saying that all of the incidents are purely due to passenger behavior, but we've seen a spike in independent actions that are against policy and what the driver would offer.
Have any of the drivers been issued citations for improper driving?
I could get that information for a future.
And is there a certain number of times that they have accidents or crashes that they're dismissed?
There is progressive discipline and safety points that correlate specifically to certain actions, yes.
If I could just add that this was the first full year that we've implemented door-to-door service. We had an exhaustive training to prepare for that. I think that it did help customers to understand things like that door-to-door doesn't mean the seventh floor of a building somewhere, but it's actually the first exterior door. But as our drivers are taking customers across terrain that previously they were waiting for us at the curb, you know, there are many things that are coming within our notice now that we're seeing that if they were at the curb, if they'd fallen or having difficulty getting to the vehicle, we would not have seen that because we'd be at the street. So now that we're assisting them back and forth, you know, to and from the vehicle, you know, that's included in our reporting now. So definitely there's more work for us to train the drivers, to point out, you know, potential hazards. And as, you know, as Selene is saying, you know, the thing is that as we extend the service to customers, many of our disabled customers are very independent-minded. They're saying, no, I really don't want that help. And we're saying, well, you know, we're not, you know, we don't want it to be something that's an impediment to them. But at the same time, you know, it's a longer path of travel now than it was under curb to curb.
Thank you for that elaboration. My mother, who is 85, is exactly one of those kinds of travelers. So I can understand what you're saying. Thank you.
Can I get a clarification on a couple things you said, though? Because of the fact that this is the first year of door-to-door, and I heard a reference to somebody leaving a building sooner, mm-hmm. which suggests that in this statistics here, in the count here, are injuries that occur between the building and boarding the vehicle.
Yes.
Okay, I think that's important because probably everybody who isn't involved in the service reads that line mm-hmm. in their
vehicle.
Mind. There's a vehicle hitting something and someone getting hurt.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to understand exactly what's behind this line and where these things are occurring. Otherwise, we don't know very much about what the meaning is of a number moving from 66 to 103. You were discussing with Mr. Giancola whether, you know, a driver's action might be at fault or something by the passenger. Of course, there's an obvious third possibility, which also isn't shown here, which is somebody else. I mean, if some number of these accidents presumably some of these injuries presumably are related to accidents or something happening in the road while a passenger's on the vehicle, in which case there's another driver. And most of the time I've ever looked at statistics, most of those situations, if there's fault found, it's with the other driver, not with the professional. So, you know, that's an important distinction, because if there was just a background rise in traffic collisions, it's entirely possible, I'm not saying it's the case, but in any given year, that we might have an increase in injuries that are not the fault of either the passenger or the driver. And we need to understand that. But the whole issue of having changed the nature of the service and therefore changed the scope of what we count as injuries in this statistic is a really important factor, it seems to me. And I would like to ask that you come back with some elaboration that lets us understand to what degree is this because we're doing something new, regardless of where fault might be or anything. It's just we just capturing. I mean, people tripped before on the way, you know, to the bus, but you didn't count that, right?
Exactly.
Figuratively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
If all of a sudden you're looking, it's just like saying, you know, crime near, you know, metro-related crime. If you count everything that happened a block from a rail station, well, then yeah, you know, but that's really not the same thing. It's something going on in the station. And so we need to have this, you know, understood a little bit so we know whether we have an operational issue, we have a contractor issue, maybe we don't, maybe we have a completely different kind of issue.
Mm-hmm.
So
we
could we, before the next meeting, get some elaboration that would
we'll provide that detail, absolutely.
Thank you. Mr. McKay was next.
I have a question on a different subject. If others want other questions on Metro Access, I yield to them and we can go to the question.
Well, anything else on access?
Yes, I'd like to follow up on your
Benjamin. Mr. Lynn.
Just following up on where Mr. Zimmerman was, I think one of the keys here also for us, and that relates to the statistics that we can understand, is there are those things we can control and those things we can't control. So if somebody slips on ice going between a door and a vehicle or vice versa, and we don't have the opportunity to do anything about that ice, that tells us something about injury rates, which we care about, but it doesn't tell us whether we need to be doing something different on safety, because there's not much we can do about that. So having those statistics somehow or other distinguish those factors is important. The other thing is we do subcontract a lot of this service beyond MV. So for instance, we have taxi operations. Are those people trained the same way that MV transportation drivers are?
Yes.
So all of those operators go through, any taxi driver who's working on one of these is getting the same training and does the same stuff.
Correct. Goes through Metro Access training. Yes.
Before they're allowed to pick anybody up.
Yes.
I need to talk to you about that.
Okay. Okay. Absolutely.
Mr. Lett.
Follow up to that same question. Is there any difference in the rates of accidents between the taxi drivers and the MV contracted drivers? Do we have that?
My sense is that the injury rate on taxi is very low.
Very low.
That has really not been a prevalent issue with them.
But is that the nature? Is there any of that related to the nature of the service or what they're doing or the amount of service that's being provided? Is there anything that you can look at in terms of those numbers that give you any indications of why that would be?
Well, they are certainly handling ambulatory customers because they don't have, for the most part, accessible vehicles. And in the course of being a taxi operator and doing what they normally do, helping people with luggage and things of that nature, I mean, some of that is already inherent in what they do. Many of them, in some cases, have been in the profession longer than a contract operator that was hired for paratransit. So, good reason to believe that that they have the right experience to minimize those types of incidents.
Yes, I just wanted to go to the part of the training as we transitioned from the curbside to door to door, because my anticipation was that one, we were going to have probably less because the concern of getting people to the vehicle as soon as possible. But you're saying that that has really contributed maybe to more of the issue. And I'd like to hear what the training anticipation was when you started this and where you are now. Because I'm sort of like Mr. Giancola, understanding that we have more of a risk involved than we had before. But did we prepare for that level of risk in the training process?
Well, the training was definitely very exhaustive. But one thing, though, that I think that several of the board members today are absolutely right about is that we need to provide you more context. Because what door-to-door essentially has done is it has made our boarding process more efficient. And that actually has been a positive for the service. And even though the raw number of injuries here is different, as Mr. Zimmerman says, we didn't put the nuance in about, what was preventable or, what part of it was associated with a collision versus something away from the vehicle. So what we're looking at is all of these numbers are being presented in the context of 22% more customers from the previous year. So the overall effect of door-to-door service is we are very efficiently moving many more people. But when we're looking at just this particular element, there has been, an increase in some of these incidents for the reasons we stated. But the training was absolutely geared toward this is different terrain, it's a different environment that you're operating in. And, there are some lessons learned in the first year that we're going to continue to apply to refresher training as we go forward.
Part of the door-to-door training in preparation for the transition was a full retraining on all passenger assistance techniques for people with varying disabilities. So it wasn't looked at as a refresher. It was as if you were a brand-new Metro Access driver going through that from the beginning.
I think context is so important because as you look at all of this, the question you would normally ask is what's different as we see these numbers change. And so in this particular case, I think it is important to put context in because we did change the service, and it is beyond just the differences of how the service is delivered across the various providers, but also how the church service changed.
We'll bring back that detail.
I think that Supervisor Hudson's remarks kind of focus on where I was going. Did we record these type of injuries before we delivered the change of service?
Well, see, they wouldn't have come within our notice if we were waiting at the curb. So I would say no, and so that definitely creates a visibility here that wasn't there before,
and perhaps an exposure.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is it you report to the insurance companies?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the number that goes to the insurance companies?
Well, it does, but it's MV, the transportation contractor's insurance, that it's being sent to. So, yes, I mean,
well,
that's their... Well, I mean, this is all part of their rate. I mean,
when we went to the door-to-door and you evaluated it, and I mean, we had a lot of discussion about whether it was going to be an increase or a decrease in cost, and reason for thinking it wouldn't increase costs. Did you take into account the potential for higher insurance costs?
Well, we did, but there was no change to the expense to Metro. The insurance carrier provides coverage to MV, whether they provide curb-to-curb or door-to-door, so there's no increase to us.
In the first instance, I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But what I wonder about is, over time, if this creates the appearance of greater exposure, if we don't wind up paying more because we're now reporting more injury than we would have.
Well, it is aggregated for the contractor over all their locations nationally. So, of course, I mean, obviously, as they report their numbers, it has an impact, but it is aggregated over locations that they have all across the country. So, you know, not knowing the rest of their safety experience, I wouldn't know what specific impact this has right now.
Ms. Hewlett's been waiting. Sorry.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up on Ms. Hudgens' question and make sure that I heard the accurate the response to it. She had asked basically what was the training anticipated at the outset of the door-to-door, and Ms. Lee, you said that, what was the training at the outset? And you said it was a full retraining as opposed to a mere refresher course. And
For the passenger assistance portion,
right.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that I think Ms. Hudgens also asked, was there any adjustment somewhere in the middle of that full year? Was there any adjustment made as you discovered how it was working? And I don't know if I heard that. I heard that you were saying you were going to, you know, you had lessons learned for the upcoming year, but I don't know if there were any adjustments made during the course of the year.
In terms of the policy or the provision of door-to-door service,
uh-huh.
Is that okay? No, we actually, one of the things that we've done since very shortly after the inception of door-to-door is that any driver who is reported to not be providing the service appropriately or completely is taken out of service immediately and has one opportunity for retraining, and if they fail to perform it successfully again, then they are no longer in the service. So we put together a pretty tight policy on removing those people who, even with effective training, are not providing the service. We have worked, obviously, to retrain and refresh people who perhaps didn't absorb all of the detail of the policy. But we have found that the policy as written, because we did take our time working with the community in advance and vetting it with all of our operational groups very thoroughly before implementing, really does work well for this environment, for these jurisdictions, for our service area. So we haven't made any alterations
so
to that.
Those interim steps were basically
correct.
Retraining some of those folks who may
correct.
Not have gotten it fully the
correct.
First time. Okay, things of that nature. But you are working with lessons learned at this point.
Yes, yes. And aspects of that also are continuing re-education of customers regarding some of those policies.
That's
and I think
too.
Yes.
Any questions on the access portion? Mr. McKay.
Yeah, thank you. I had a concern on slide 11 with the
fire incidents. It may seem like a pretty insignificant increase, 45 to 55, but, you know, if my math is right, that's over 20%. And I guess my question is, on the fires, obviously we investigate each of those, and I would assume we know the cause of each of those. And if that's the case, is it the same thing that is causing the fires repeatedly that we need to look at, or is it something different each time? What is causing the fires, and what can we do to drive that number down?
Well, that number is all conclusive. So it does include some of the fires that are sometimes that are adjacent to the track and right-of-way, which potentially causes impact. The majority of them are really related to debris and newspaper that gets, you know, caught up in our up in our third rail. And we do have some areas where we have limbs and debris that we're working on, you know, trying to clean out the right-of-way. There's been a big initiative, if you've been on 66 or down towards Franconia Springfield, where there's been a lot of, you know, tree trimming and foliage removal that hasn't been done in quite some time. So we're really concentrating those areas to help reduce that. And we are in the process of getting, we do have like two additional vacuum trucks that the order's been placed, and we've got a delivery time frame so we can go after that and adjust that as well. But we do, the fires also include, for example, we'll have lamp fixtures that are in the track bed. And if those get wet or if those have a short, that's also reported, you know, in that roll-up. But we can get a better breakdown of what's taking place.
So as we're repairing and replacing those, are we trying to address that issue with the lighting?
Absolutely. For example, whenever we have these large outages, weekend outages, we are going through and replacing lights and addressing things, upgrading materials and equipment that hasn't been touched, you know, they're 20 plus years of the base.
And just going back real quickly to the comment you made about limbs and other debris, are these fires occurring repeatedly in the same locations, or are we seeing this increase, you know, system-wide? I mean, obviously, there are areas where we have increased limbs and we have more trash in our stations. Is there a reason? Is there a correlation between those two directly?
An area, for example, that we're really focused on is at our portal areas, where we come out from a below grade to above grade. And if we have a lot of foliage and stuff, and there's a kind of like a Venturi effect that really draws a lot of debris in that area and pulls it back. So what we're looking at is not just the pickup, but it's also trying to preempt those areas to make sure that we don't have potential for needles or limbs to get caught up in there. The newspaper in the trash, it's really, you know, a kind of a random thing. It's very hard for us to, you know, to control of that nature because we do have the debris collectors that we had installed in all of our below grade stations, which, you know, has helped. But if, for example, we've seen this, probably 5 to 6 fires are related where people are wadding up newspapers and they're throwing them across and they're landing on the light lens assemblies. And they sit there and then all of a sudden they start smoking and, you know, that gets reported in that.
Well, just as a follow-up, perhaps when we're considering our public service announcements that we put something in about that, about trash and about debris, because, a fire is a pretty significant incident. And quite frankly, you know, we're focusing on passenger safety. It doesn't help, you know, have these things, this number going up. And if it's something the passengers can do to help deal with the problem that we're having, we need to make them aware of that so that they understand that in some meaningful way. Because otherwise, I see that number continuing to escalate. I doubt we're going to have reductions in trash in our cars unless we make some policy changes, which we don't want to do. So we need to tell our passengers about the danger in doing that if that's a driver in these incidents.
Okay. I think we also need to understand better what makes up this number.
Yes.
Because how many of them are newspapers, you know, and how many of them are branches? At the very least, could you tell us how many of them occur in tunnels versus in the exposed right-of-way? Because there's a different level of control, obviously, and a different level of responsibility. What goes on in the tunnels, we're pretty much responsible for everything.
Yeah, this is a summary report, Mr. Zimmerman. I understand. We do have this broken down, and we can definitely get that to you.
In order to draw any conclusions, though, or what our practice ought to be, we'd have to have some idea. I mean, if there's a lot of branches and leaves one year to the next, and that winds up with, you know, some sort of minor incidents that you may not be able to control, that's very different than saying we have a bunch of equipment that's failing, you know, that's generating fires. And so we'll need to add some sense of that in order to be able to evaluate what the meeting was.
I don't want to belabor this, but I think it's so important that that message gets out as we report this, because as you read that summary, it's clearly we want it reported with the context of it, and I just have to do an anecdote that getting off the train yesterday after some teenagers had sat, every newspaper that was on the train in the area had been shredded into little pieces all over the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And I can only hear what you're saying in that once that starts to move into a track area, it becomes, and so if I read that there's an increase in fires, none of that context comes into play in terms of what our challenges are in trying to control the environment that we're working in. And I think you're correct, we always see the differences under the detail, but it just needs to be highly emphasized that there are so many inconsolable pieces there.
We view every one of those as a potential, you know, impact of the performance of the rail system, so there's a lot of review that goes into each one of those, and we'll be more than happy to give you the detail.
Mr. Benjamin.
Just understanding the numbers some more. We did have one really horrific accident, which contributed an enormous number of injuries. How many out of the 110 in there are from that one accident?
I'm not mistaken, it was 70.
Good. It was 70 that was involved in that 70. Particular accident.
So you're saying that not including that single accident, which admittedly is a significant, significant accident, that number would have gone down?
Absolutely.
From 77 to 40?
Yes, sir.
A reduction of 37. So it says that our background rate, not including one really bad accident, in fact is improving, and that would imply something about our overall safety, not including that one accident. And again, I'm not trying to minimize the accident. I'm trying to understand what we're doing in terms of training our people and working on improving our overall safety. And the same thing, the rail transit facility occupants came down rather enormously. Can you tell us why you think that's happening?
Because of the escalator.
Yeah.
I don't want to make the assumption because it's relatively new to me, but one would think that the ice, the activity associated with bad weather, the ability to get out and take protective precautionary measures, that's an assumption on my part.
Okay. It'd be worth looking into because, again, it's telling us, are we doing the right kinds of things in general? Same thing with escalator injuries. The number's gone down rather dramatically. So I just wanted to put all of this in something of a context, which tells us there's sort of a background rate and there's this one really terrible thing that happened. If you take that out, are we doing reasonably? And the answer seems to be, and I guess that one accident also affected the rail passenger injury rate, that's why that went up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that gives us some useful information. Just wanted to make sure I understood it.
On the fires also, I think this is true of many of them, but in particular I'm interested in the experience over a number of years. There are some things that are, you know, in some ways random, and some have to do with, you know, actual changes in practice or something that's going on, and you can only, you know, from one year to the next, you can't necessarily pick up this 10 change plus or minus. Is that a big deal? You don't really know unless you see it. In the past, we've had some significant issues with track, before any of you were here, we had significant issues with track fires, and my recollection is that it went down considerably. So part of what I'm interested in with that is saying, has it changed, you know, is it bouncing around some mean, or is it, you know, is it in fact going back up again? I can't conclude that from anything we've seen here, but I think it's, since the issue's been raised, we ought to take a look at that and see, you know, how we think we're really doing. Other questions? Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, you know, the communication element is particularly important here. I ride the Metro, certainly when I commute every day, but also during the day to go to various meetings I go to, and I still don't hear enough announcements and promotion of you know, place your papers, unused papers into the receptacles. You know, they're creating problems. The issue of no eating or drinking, I still have really never heard an announcement personally saying no eating or drinking. And so I think you know, we need to be communicating this constantly to our riders, and I just don't think we do a good enough job at it.
Okay. I would also like to ask about the thing you had on the very first slide with a signaling device that you're testing that would obviously be, apparently be for the protection of track walkers. Can you give us an idea what the time frame is? This is a testing there.
Yeah, we've presently presently we've conducted tests that are above grade. We've done initiatives in the yard, and we're in the process of testing the equipment below grade. We expect to have this report finalized in March of 2010. So that way we can have an evaluation of the status of where we're at with this equipment as it applies to our system and infrastructure.
Sorry, say that date again.
Okay.
And hear that date.
The date.
The date, March 2010, when we will have our report finalized on this equipment.
Okay, so in March, you hope to have a report that says, we tried it out, this is what we think.
Yes, sir.
And then you're going to be in a position to say, is this something we should deploy?
Yes, sir.
And if you do determine, yeah, this is a, you know, it's a good measure that, you know, could increase safety, now that's going to be a capital project, I assume.
We will have cost estimates and the impact to operational, that is part of our evaluation criteria as well.
But I assume at this point you already know, if you wanted to do it, what it would cost to implement.
Not on the grand scale, because we're talking about modifications to rolling stock rail cars as well as for our wayside workers.
Well, what I'm wondering is if you determine in March that this is a good idea, it seems to me that it will become an imperative to actually do, because if you know that it works, there won't be any good reason to not do it.
Correct.
That's correct.
Considering everything. And we're going to be fairly well into the budget process at that point. So I'm wondering how it becomes part of the immediate, you know, capital plan, since it would presumably rise to the top of things to be done.
If I may. It's part of the legislation that's providing the $150 million in federal funding with the matching dollars. There is a provision that the money is first used to implement the recommendations of the NTSB and other safety-related equipment. And as I stated this morning, when those funds come in, I will be bringing to you early in the year a procurement for the 1,000 replacements for the 1,000 series rail cars, and it will be the same timing within a month or so of this report. And again, the first cut on those dollars are safety-related issues such
as
this.
That's making my point.
Yeah.
My question is, are you going to be in a position to structure the capital program for the immediate first year, or, you know, as soon as we do it, because this would be top of the list in that time frame?
Yes, sir. I've been looking at the capital, evaluating, you know, some of the projects, and we are pushing the safety-related items, you know, up to the top to seeing what we actually need to do, and how we will conduct this, and how we will implement this. The other thing is looking at the spending pattern and the availability for these products, you know, to be delivered and implemented, because whenever we're talking about the potential of equipping everything that the agency has, this is something that is not just going to happen in, you know, a month or 2 months. You're talking about possibly 3 years of deployment. So that would be factored in into our evaluation, as well as a presentation to kind of let you know the overall impact of what this device or equipment might have.
Is it safe to say this is in the tens of millions of dollars?
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, this is one aspect of safety to which you will have to be responsive. There obviously are others. For instance, we have to have this new system that has to be developed and, you know, implemented that will allow us to return to automatic train control, that is to detect loss of signal. That we don't know exactly what that is yet. We just know it's something we're going to have to do. You start adding these things up, these could be fairly large components in a capital budget that would require significant restructuring well into our process, and they will command first dollars. So that seems to suggest that we're going to have a lot of uncertainty about what goes into our capital budget well into the process, after we've done hearings even.
Yes.
And
that could impact whether you can, I mean, at some point, whether or not you can make the order for rail cars that you're talking about can be impacted on the basis of, well, do I do that or do I implement these, you know, 3, 4, 5 safety measures that have been identified?
Well, you're right. There is an impact. What we are doing under the capital plan, we have items identified as well as some estimates for certain programs. For an example, you're absolutely right. We do not know what the recommendation will be from the NTSB. That hasn't occurred yet. And I suspect that will occur well after the planning process. And our capital budget will be set up as we bring that to you with that flexibility, as best as we know, of funds, you know, identified for that. But again, we're not sure of all the steps we have to take. And there will be some steps that we did not anticipate, which means we'd have to come back to you for shifting of funds.
Okay. Further questions? Mr. Graham and then Mr.
Lee. I just was struck by a phrase you just used, which is well after the planning process. But could you flesh that out a little bit?
Well, the budget process is the board is scheduled at this point to approve the next year's budget in June, the board meeting in June. I do not know when the NTSB will complete their investigation and issue a final report with recommendations. If that happens to be after the board has approved the budget, then we would have to come back to modify the budget to handle those recommendations. If they make the recommendations, and I don't have a date, I don't know what their date is, early in the budget process, then we can make modifications before the final budget is approved. That's what I was articulating.
So you don't expect any finding on probable cause of this accident, which is the operative term that the NTSB's must establish as their judgment? You don't see that happening before June?
I'm not going to say what the dates are from my perspective. I only can repeat what the chairman of the NTSB said, and also past history and investigations. 2 days after the accident, the chair said it would be a year before the report is issued. If they do it earlier, then I think that's wonderful. But I'm only going based upon the communications that they have given.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think it's very, very important that the public understand that we don't know what it is that we're to be fixing.
Yep.
We don't know how tall an order that is. We don't know how expensive that's going to be. I mean, I've referred to it frequently as the giant wild card in this whole discussion that we're having about our budget, our spending pressures, and everything else. And, you know, and whatever, and there's, it links into so many issues in terms of this past year. You know, because of the criticism, the public concern, and so on and so forth, you know, and the public needs to know that we still don't know what it is that we're supposed to be fixing in order to prevent a similar collision from occurring. And so it's a, forgive my French, but it's a damnable situation to be in, considering the seriousness, which you've already alluded to, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Benjamin, you know, that we're facing. And it seems to me that the responsible course of action would be for the NTSB to accelerate its finding on probable cause so that we can incorporate all of that into our budget discussions, we can incorporate it into our public discussions and everything else. So, I know that's a voice crying in the wilderness.
I think it's a really important point for people to understand, because I think it's difficult for people to, you know, it's been a long time, and as far as everybody knows, the investigation was done months ago. And so they think that, you know, we ought to be now on to fixing whatever it was that caused the problem. And although many of us suspect that what caused the problem is known, as well as it's ever going to be known, until they actually give the word,
right,
you know, we can't really move on that. And we can start moving on something, and then they can say to do something completely different. And these are large orders of magnitude projects we're talking about. So it's a very difficult situation.
And if I may add, having been on this board in 2004 when the Woodley collision occurred, you know, I recall very well what I would characterize, I'm just speaking for myself, a fairly cavalier attitude on the part of the NTSB when it said to us, replace all the 1,000 series cars. You know, it was like in a paragraph in their report. Well, you know, and we need something far more, far more detailed, far more appreciative of the challenges that we're facing. If they're just going to toss off a recommendation, which is very substantial and profound in terms of its impact, that's going to really not help us at all, and it won't help anybody involved in this at all. And we saw what happened to their recommendations in 2004. We, in fact, acted upon them. We are replacing the 1,000 series cars, but it's not the type of thing you can just say, oh, you know, do this. Let us know when all the cars are replaced, please, you know, and so on. So that's my little vent for the day. Thank you.
Someone else?
Mr. Linton, Mr. Yu.
Thank you. I think I was going to ask the questions that Mr. Zimmerman started it now, so I guess I have to go back to it. ProTram, the signaling system that you're looking at, one of my concerns is that what we have this need to respond to an issue that's surfacing on our rail lines and with our track workers and others. Want to make sure that what we buy is the best in class and that we don't rush to buy because one, there's both the need and the money. Sometimes being driven by that, you don't necessarily make the right purchases. Is this ProTram signal system device being deployed anywhere else?
It is being tested in other areas of the United States. For example, Baltimore, I believe, is in the process of implementing this. We've been into contact, for example, with New York City to see how they're applying this, and I know that they have tested it, and they are inconclusive at this time. But we are on your point.
So that's the testing versus deployed?
Yes.
So it's being tested in other places as it is in our environment, but it has not been deployed. Is that the answer?
That is correct.
Are there similar devices that others have manufactured that have been, at least their allegations or their statement would be that they have a similar device that could in fact provide the same or similar level of alert to our track walkers?
We have talked with other vendors. Primarily here in the States, you don't really have a large concentration of this sophisticated equipment. So there is some material that we've been looking at over in from Europe that they utilize on a regular basis. But far stateside, your selection opportunities are very limited.
Yeah, well, we're not limited to the states because obviously if you go to the nation and buy America, even some of that would be waived. So we're not limited to the states. But you know, the question once again is, and I'm not defining my desire to look at best in class to states. It's the entire universe. So the question once again rises: have we had an opportunity to look at other products that's been deployed? Actually, because I would imagine, from my experience, that very often in Europe and Asia and other places, because of the investment in the R&D that they've done. And even making the kind of capital that's been put into their systems, and very often they have deployed devices earlier than we have here in the United States, and it's often less than months. Okay.
It's for us, it's a process. We're testing and evaluating this product. We will see whether or not it will work and it will actually add value to our system. The number one thing is the importance is the safety to the employees out there, their input, their feedback, you know, the environment there which they're placed in. This equipment must be flawless, and that's the evaluation criteria that we're working with. We have looked overseas to see what they are doing from a testing standpoint. Some of the equipment we will have to go through a Buy America portion. We're also looking at the options of maybe buying like a small segment like what we're doing with ProTrans, so that we don't go after an elaborate system and you test it in specific areas. So we are exhaustively looking at our options out there to improve safety for the track walkers out there.
So we're buying the product to test?
What I did on this ProTram process is that I did not want to put the agency in a position where I tested a demo. I was looking for an off-the-shelf product that is commercially available, no strings attached, and I procured devices. And now we began the test. It makes me very, very leery whenever somebody offers us the option to say, well, let me give you a demo, and you work kind of work through it. I want it service proven out of the box. And so it takes a little bit longer whenever you approach things in that manner, but I think it's the most prudent way for us to truly test equipment that adds value and safety to our employees.
I actually appreciate that perspective, actually. The other point of that matter, though, is are there other similar devices that we could also be testing in other locations in our rail system so that we have one or two or three that we've tested, looked at the comparable devices, test them with the same time period, begin to evaluate them against each other, and then make a deployment decision. Otherwise, what you've done, you have one device that you can test for a significant period of time, and you make your decision based upon the testing of that device sold.
Yes, sir, we are looking at multiple items. This was just noted as ProTram because this is one of the areas that we bought, but I would look at two or three others before I would say officially this is where we need to go.
Thank you.
Yeah, I apologize if this question has been already asked. With regards to the Metro Access passenger injuries, 66 and 208 and 103 and 209, what's driving that? What kind of injuries?
The type of injuries I'm going to ask Christian to discuss, but as discussed earlier, and looking at the number of injuries and the type, they are ones where where people are not keeping their restraints on as well as.
This is actually something we had a considerable discussion on right at the beginning of this, so it might be more useful to you to have staff afterwards.
All right, thanks for me. It's been done.
Yeah. Anything further? Any questions then? If not, let me say, to kind of go back to where you began at the beginning, Mr. Arroyo, with your statement overall, and Chief Tabor noted that the Federal Transit Administration this week began their triennial audit here. I had the opportunity to sit on the initial meeting with WMATA management, and that was very instructive to me. And I'll say that I think that Mr. Cato, Mr. Kubitschek, and Chief Taborn gave very frank responses to everything that was being asked, and I think it was a very good conversation to begin what is an important exercise. Always, obviously, would be important, but especially this year is important to all of us. I'm very anxious to see, and I think board members will be anxious to see what the final report says and what indications it gives us as to what changes we may need to make. That's one part of a process. We have a lot that has to go on. And as I think you made clear, Mr. Cato, you can't be waiting for recommendations either. The things that you're doing right now and going to have to do. One of the issues, of course, is this sort of overall question of what is the culture of safety. And I was struck by some things that have been said that I think we need to bear in mind. One being that it's not just a matter of having a safety office or having some part of the organization that does safety, but that it has to be the business of everybody. And that particularly if there's a question that I think we need to understand better, it's whether our operations have been responsive as they need to be to those who specifically work in safety. And I know this is something you're evaluating now, so you don't necessarily have an answer to that. I'm not looking for that. But over time, I am looking to see essentially that evaluation. Are we doing on an ongoing basis what we need to respond to changing demands in the area of safety? And I assume that that will be part of your consideration as you look for a chief safety officer, which you are now recruiting for.
That is true. The answer is yes, we're doing many things, but also with that answer, it is not enough. And I'm not happy as nor is the chief on what we have achieved thus far. We need to do a lot more. It needs to reach down into the core of the organization, but it also has to reach at the top of the organization for accountability. And We are in the process, as we said here, of enacting other actions, and we're working with Jackie Jeter to ensure that we can expand not just the discussion, not just the rules. When you talk to employees, I think one of the things that will come out of the audit, they have safety meetings. They can talk about DuPont, but have there been a significant enough change? And for me, the answer, we need to go further. And this process is, how do we get it deeper and get people to really make a change, not just listen to it and get a piece of paper, but actually make a change?
Thank you. Let me move on to the crime report. Chief?
Good morning. Jeff Dolinsky, and I'll be presenting the Metro Transit Police Crime Statistics and Significance Facts Report. The Metro Transit Police Department is hosting a series of emergency management exercises over the next several months. We plan on hosting 3 tactical exercises and 2 tabletop exercises. The first tactical exercise is tentatively scheduled for President's Day holidays, mid-February. Of course, these exercises are designed to test the response capabilities of local law enforcement, fire, and emergency management. Funding for this training initiative is through the Urban Area Security Initiative and managed by Arlington County Fire Department. Our robbery squad continues to do very good work within the Metrorail system. On October 28th, our robbery squad arrested 5 young adults for robbery at the Tenleytown Metrorail station. And on November 6th, they arrested 2 young adults at the Deanwood Metrorail station for robbery, bringing the total arrest statistics for the robbery squad since May up to 77. On December 7th, Metro Transit Police Department began deploying 5 anti-terrorism teams, each team consisting of 4 uniformed police officers. Their responsibilities are for high visibility patrol, identifying suspicious persons and activities, and sharing intelligence with local law enforcement agencies. This program is paid for through the Transit Security Grant Program for the next 3 years. We talk about police partnerships. The Metro Transit Police Department has been invited to participate in the Municipal Police Chiefs Association of Prince George's County, Maryland, which consists of several municipal agencies within the county there. Hyattsville included, Greenbelt, University of Maryland, Burren Heights, to name a few. They meet monthly to discuss a number of topics, to include crime, training, technology, and intelligence. Some of the things on the latest agenda that they spoke about was getting together an anti-gang task force for the Maryland area. Current projects include us working with local law enforcement agencies in this region to compare and contrast crime stats, particularly in the parking lots. We're going to look at parking facilities that park more than 500 vehicles at a time. And right now we're looking at shopping malls as a likely comparison to the metro parking facilities. We're also looking at collecting crime statistics from other transit properties across the country to see how we fare on a national level. Okay, and these comparisons will be presented in the January committee meeting, I believe scheduled for January 28th. The good news is that through January through October, bus operator assaults are down 29%. 60 assaults have been reported to us so far this year compared to 85 last year. And I have a lot of confidence in those numbers because I personally asked for an audit of our statistics last week to make sure those are completely accurate, and I'm very comfortable with those numbers. We also have high-intensity targeted enforcement that continues at bus stops along problematic bus routes. On November 4th, we're at Anacostia, running a height. November 25th at Fort Totten, and on December 9th at Potomac Avenue. Also, something that went into effect October 1st was new legislation in Maryland making it a crime to hinder transit operations by assaulting a Metrobus or Metrorail operator. This crime carries a penalty of up to $1,000 and/or 90 days imprisonment. And of course, the District of Columbia passed similar legislation last April, making it also a crime to hinder transit operations.
Similar penalties.
Similar penalties, 1.5 times normal rate. So the probability of being a victim of a Part 1 crime in the metro system is 4.14 per million riders. This is a slight uptick over last month, largely due to the number of robberies that we're experiencing right now, roughly a 30% increase. But as you see in the appendix and the crime statistics, aggravated assaults are down, larcenies and motor vehicle thefts are all down for this year so far. As far as the Transit Police Department activity, law enforcement activity, received almost 49,000 calls for service so far this year, made over 1,600 arrests, issued 5,500 criminal and civil citations, and wrote over 4,000 fare evasion citations. The rest of the statistical information is attached in the appendix.
There you go. Other questions? Mr. Yule.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Great job in terms of what the MTPD has been trying to do or has done in terms of robbery, but with the 37% increase, is there some other, are there some other actions that can be taken to get our hands around this? That just, it's, you know, the fear is that if the system isn't safe, then obviously it's going to hurt our ridership.
Absolutely. One of the things I talked about today was the...
And let me also preface the fact that, you know, this is not unthinkable, particularly during these hard economic times, that, you know, we're you know, in all of our jurisdictions, we're seeing an increase in assaults and robberies, but we need to be employing different tactics to address that.
Absolutely. As I spoke about just a few minutes ago, is the effectiveness of the robbery squad that we have out, the plainclothes officers that go out there, not only look for robberies that are about to occur, but also pose as decoys. They themselves dress up in plain clothes and sometimes play the part of the victim, and as a result, end up getting robbed themselves, which results in a quick apprehension of those suspects who want to do that. The idea there is to get the word out amongst their networks that if they come into the metro system to commit a robbery, they may be robbing a police officer and thus not getting away with it. So that's one thing that we feel very strongly about. We're going to continue doing that, maybe even increase the numbers of that unit since it's so successful. But we've also, for 3 months of this year so far, made station announcements that advise our customers to pay extra special attention to their property when they travel in the system, to not wear their headphones, and just be vigilant of their surroundings. We've also had several public awareness campaigns where we've gone to parking garages, to metro platforms, to mezzanines, to hand out literature, safe travel tips, to interact with our riders, to give them advice on while they ride, maybe during evening hours and so forth, or when they park in parking lots. We've had high visibility details at Gallery Place, Metro Center, and Lafont Plaza, three areas that are particularly experiencing an uptick in the robbery snatch type of crimes that are occurring. And we're also aggressively pursuing the initiative that the District of Columbia and Fairfax County initiated last year by putting crime cameras up at the station entrances. And through the Urban Area Security Initiative grant process, we were able to secure $2.7 million funding to put crime cameras up at every Metro Rail station entrance in the entire system, an additional 153 cameras. So that is underway as we speak.
Thank you.
Mr. Graham. How many, thank you very much. I too appreciate all the work that's being done here. How many police officers at MTPD are in the stations?
As a matter of fact,
distinguished from other
roughly 300 of the 450 sworn.
300 of the 400. And where are the other 150?
I would like to add that no matter where you are assigned, you have a responsibility to the metro stations, the trains. Just because you may be assigned to the training division, for instance, that doesn't mean you don't ride the metro rail system or ride the bus system and take action when it occurs in front of you. So we have our own training division, we have detectives, we have officers assigned to parking lot enforcement, plainclothes officers who do surveillance and make apprehensions of those people who come in our parking lots to steal things. We basically have just about a full-service police department, so no matter what occurs, whether it be threats to the system, anti-terrorism type initiatives, or whether it be a regular patrol, we all have a responsibility.
But 30% of our officers are not in the stations, but some percentage of those are in the parking lots, which I would include. Can we, Mr. Chairman, let me ask for a breakdown on all of this.
Should be provided.
I've had some very disturbing emails, as you know. I think Chief Tabor knows, and the general manager knows, in the past month, in relating to calls for service that have not gotten the type of response. In one case, there was a person who felt very much threatened in a rail car, and he or she called repeatedly. They had to go through three stations before they finally got somebody to respond. This is very alarming to me. And so that prompts this line of questioning. The second thing is that I'm wondering, and I know we typically that police and civilian employees have a kind of a fast separation, they have a hard separation, but I think there's something more our station managers could be doing, our other employees could be doing, at least insofar as getting help in situation. It seems as though our other employees are perhaps have even been instructed to just stay out of the public safety role, and this relates to Mayor Ewell's question, which is what more can we be doing, because we have other personnel resources in these stations, and they don't seem to be encouraged or trained to respond in a meaningful way when people are in desperate need of help. Can I have a response to that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes. And also, you will get a response from the standpoint of what they can do. What we do not report here and what we need to report is the many occurrences where they do assist customers in events. It's from a medical perspective as well as any other threats. The majority of those you don't hear about because you do not get an email from someone concerning that. But we do receive many letters and emails from our customers directly here. So we need to somehow put that together. I don't know if that would be the overall comprehensive one, but also look at employee reports that they submit when an event does take place.
So is there something more we can do with these employees?
There's always something more we can do. I just think, and we will, but I think one of the issues that we need to communicate is what they are doing already. You know, every month when we bring an employee to the board, and it happens many more times than those people we bring, as a result of them providing this type of assistance.
Well, let me just conclude by saying that it would be helpful to me to have you, Mr. Cato, reconstruct what happened in this particular case, which, if my memory serves me correctly, is within the last 2 weeks.
I agree.
Where somebody felt trapped in a rail car and threatened through several stations before assistance came. Can you reconstruct that for me tell me what happened and why there wasn't assistance sooner?
Yes.
In response to these cell phone calls?
Yes.
Ms. Bedwins.
May I, Chief Walensky, ask the question that Mr. Graham asked slightly differently?
Sorry.
At any given moment, say during the peak hour, can you tell us how many sworn officers are physically on a train, in a station, or riding a bus in uniform out of your 450?
When we talk about deployment, you're specifically asking for one given rush hour. Say today at 4 o'clock, how many officers will be in the system?
Fine. That sounds good. And on a bus, in a station, on a train, in uniform.
Parking lot. Yeah.
Now, I want to have the people that everybody sees, that our customers know are there.
Without going through and identifying each single one, counting them up, I would say roughly 50 officers at any given time in the system.
So, yeah, and I think that's very significant, because I think one of the things, and I've talked about this before, one of the things that's really critical in terms of giving our customers a sense that they are safe is seeing uniformed officers around. and we don't see as many, or we get the impression that we don't see as many as we used to. And I think one of the things I'd like to see us work on is, mentioned this to Chief Taborn, is work on making more officers visible more often. Yeah, I know you can use a car to get to places quicker because you don't have to ride a train and that takes longer, but you're not visible when you're sitting in a car.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more, and those changes have been taking place over the last several weeks, particularly with the addition of the 20 anti-terrorism officers. That's main responsibility is to high visibility, interact with customers, and identify suspicious behavior in our system. So you will see them out regularly.
And we also have an initiative whereby we are redeploying those people who are assigned to the revenue protection officers, because that's a group of people that aren't specifically assigned to field operations to respond to calls for service. However, they too are still out in the system because they're providing protection for the men and women who are servicing the revenue machines. And so what we're going to be doing starting January is to passing off the permanent placement of those people back into patrol and still affording the revenue attendants that same level of protection. So when they are in the station, they will have someone protecting their back when they're servicing the machine. But once those servicing the machines are completed, they will remain on patrol and not follow the revenue attendants around. And so working with Carol Kissel and Treasury, we're looking to roll that out. That will add an additional 15 to 20 police officers to patrolling the system.
Thank you. Given my background, I'm pleased that you qualified that appropriately. A question that I ask almost every time, and if you just say it, then I won't ask it. I just want to get a clarification again so that I understand. Larcenies are taking something from something other than a person.
Correct.
Like stealing something out of a car.
Is that right? Without the use of force or threat of force.
Okay. So our larceny is people stealing things out of primarily vehicles?
Correct.
GPSs and radios and stuff like that?
Yes.
Okay. Just so that I understand those. And robberies are, I'm actually taking something from you, but not with force or threat, is that right? Or is it, I'm going up to you with a gun, or is it, I picked your pocket?
All of the above.
All of the above.
Robberies encompass anything taken by the use of force.
Okay.
Or stealth.
Or stealth.
Which would be a case of a pickpocket, which is still classified as a robbery.
So are the vast majority of these snatching an iPhone or an iPod or something like that?
Absolutely. The biggest trend we see now is the increase of small electronic devices being snatched out of people's hands while they're in transit, mainly on the trains as the doors are getting ready to close on the train car. A suspect will reach in, grab the item from the victim, run off the train, doors close, train leaves the station. By the time we get the call and meet with the victim, a considerable amount of time has elapsed, giving the suspect ample time to make good his escape.
So if I'm sitting on the train listening to my iPod and have it in my shirt pocket, am I safe or not safe from that being grabbed?
It's in your shirt pocket?
Yeah.
It depends on several different things. What we see is with the bad guys, the suspects, they're basically looking for opportunities. And if you're sitting there with the iPod in your shirt pocket, or there's somebody else on the other side of the train with it in their hand in a similar type of situation, that person may pose as an easier target for the suspect. So that's what they'll direct their attention to. So it depends on a number of different circumstances that are taking place at the time.
Well, I think we're unlikely to get people to stop listening to their iPods, and now that we're giving them more opportunities to use their cell phones, we're unlikely to get them to stop using their cell phones. Are there ways that we can tell our passengers how they can do those things and minimize their risk?
The best piece of advice I could give them is not to make themselves look conspicuous or vulnerable in these types of situations. Just because you're wearing earphones or carrying your iPod doesn't mean you couldn't be scanning the environment, looking for people that are attempting to approach you for some reason or another. And if you're in that situation where you feel uncomfortable, you feel like someone's watching you, take the earphones out, put the iPod away, and maybe get close to one of the emergency intercoms so if something were to happen, you can alert the train operator right away.
So if I'm sitting here with my iPod in my shirt pocket and I'm snoozing, that's not good.
Not good at all.
If we can find ways to let our passengers know a little bit more about that, that might be helpful. Finally, if I look at these statistics and if I interpret them correctly, it looks like the stations of New Carrollton and Southern Avenue individually have substantially more crime than any other station anywhere in the system. Is that right?
When you talk about
theater.
Yes, there's two categories.
Well,
here.
No. If you add it all up, if you add it all up, they've got more, no matter how you do it.
Can I ask, you know, it would be helpful. I mean, I see you've split it up into top tens in each of the jurisdictions. Can we get a single chart which shows the top 10 for the whole system? And that will answer those questions.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm concerned about here is if I add it all up, they're well above any place else if you add them all up.
Yes.
And are we doing anything about that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I do have with me here a breakdown of all 86 Metrorail stations based on vehicle crime, crime against person, and then those numbers combined. So they're rank order 1 through 86, and I'll provide those to the board.
Are we increasing our enforcement in those areas?
Absolutely. We have been now for some time. We've had mixed results, obviously. The problem is, for instance, when we place our resources at New Carrollton, for instance, make an arrest, the crimes stop occurring for a couple weeks, okay? Crime happens someplace else. We have to redeploy resources. And then we turn around and something else happens at New Carrollton. So it's kind of a cat and mouse game. We try and stay ahead of crime the best we can, and I think we do a very good job of predicting trends and patterns and so forth. But to have resources deployed to one location 365 days a year isn't effective and isn't efficient use of resources. So we try and address those patterns as they're happening. And they're not always at New Carrollton. We're not always at Southern Avenue. Top two.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Linton, let me advise our board chair that it looks like we are likely to go over time in this committee. We'll try to see what happens. Mr. Linton.
Oh, so I'd be interested in looking at some comparative analysis of our number of police officers that we have compared to other systems of size. And in terms of comparable, if we can even do it by mileage, of coverage, so we get some real sense of the per passenger kind of numbers of police availability. I know it's very easy to talk about how many visible police officers we should have on our system. I think we need to also reflect what comparative numbers of available officers are across the country, how we match up with that, and how that relates to the amount of coverage that our officers also have to provide. So I like to put that in some context as we look at this.
Will do.
Same thing with the New Carrollton and other kind of places where we have a significantly higher number of vehicle crimes. What does that do in terms of reflecting those facilities, in terms of parking spaces, number of the vehicles, how does that track those numbers?
I'm sorry, I didn't know.
If you look at West Hyattsville, how many parking spaces are there versus in New Carrollton?
Okay.
What's the percentage of crimes? Vehicles, how much is that related to the number of vehicles that are at those facilities?
Space.
Well,
understood.
I think you know these numbers have to be fleshed out in terms of what they really reflect.
It was agreed.
Kind of like a usury. Good idea.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Chairman, that's expensive. Further questions on this?
Can I make sure that we get that consolidated chart? And
yes.
And have it hereafter as well, the consolidated chart. showing the top 10 for the whole system.
Right, that's an additional chart. We're not going to take these away because...
No, we keep these charts. These are very important, but yes. I just would like to see the additional one. Yes.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. We have another item, and I think it's one of the there will be some interest in concerning the smart trip and the smart benefits. Ongoing situation for us both. Mr. Cato, I assume Ms. Kissel is...
Yeah, Ms. Kissel will be making a presentation.
Thank you.
Trying to get additional seats over here in the front.
Actually, I'm going to have Cindy Zeman, who is the acting, or actually the director for the Smart Trip office, provide the update for the Smart Trip benefit program, as well as Charlie Hunter will be here to answer any technical questions that the committee might have for the
Charlie
presentation. Hunter.
Okay, we'll let you give your presentation, and we will have questions.
I'm sure.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning. This presentation, thank you. We're going to give you a quick update on the Smart Trip project, the Smart Trip Next Fair project, Smart Benefits in the IRS. The implementation of various customer features and an automatic fare collection strategy that the agency is working on. Next slide. The Smart Trip project components, good to go ahead and give just a real quick update on that or brief overview of what that includes. It's not only the actual Smart Trip Next Fare system upgrade, but it also includes the features that lays the groundwork for the benefits in terms of parking and separating the parking and transit benefits, as well as the customer features for compact point of sale devices, passes, the self-service website, and the auto load feature that we have been we're trying to work on. Next slide. This is just to describe graphically, while it looks like it's a simple project to simply updating a couple of the different areas, Metro Rail, Metro Bus, and our regional partners to the Next Fare 5 system, it's not so simple. It's very complex. We have a, because of our complex fare structure and the fare structures of our regional partners, it requires an intensive, comprehensive testing all along the way as we do this upgrade because we want it to be transparent to our customers. Staff needs to ensure the solid operation of the current system so that we don't disrupt the service, as well as making sure that we don't the complexity comes in as we're upgrading the various pieces. Rail, for instance, the rail stations. Not all stations are occurring or upgrade is occurring at the same time. So we have to make sure that there's backward compatibility between all the rail stations and the cards being read. Likewise with the buses. So as each division or each regional partner was upgraded, and as each metro division was, bus division was upgraded, or the buses of the division, we had to make sure that they were still compatible, that the card could still read at the various, within the various different versions that we had working in the system. Again, same thing happened with our regional partners. Staff is being very careful, again, that we don't jeopardize or disrupt the current operation of the system for anybody regionally. And we've also had concerns that if it did disrupt it, not only would it disrupt the operation, but it could, in fact, create a safety hazard as more people are congregating at the gates trying to get through, perhaps on the platform, and even actually trying to get down through the escalators. So we're cognizant of that. So that's what we've been keeping up with and trying to work on as we're working through this project, keeping that in mind. Next one. This just simply outlines very briefly the when we're saying sequential process, it's sequential in terms of how we're deploying it throughout the system. We have to make sure that, first of all, we lab test internally. We do field testing of the software and the hardware. If there are any issues, that we debug them. We evaluate the results, and if it's positive, then we move forward to the next deployment area, deployment section. If not, then we go back and we retest and reevaluate those results until we get it right. We are doing concurrent testing, piloting, evaluation all along the way where we can. But again, the staff is very cognizant of the operation now and not to do anything that actually disrupts it or creates a problem for our customers.
Chris. Next question. I was trying to hold questions.
All right, okay.
Go ahead.
because I thought we'd talk about it when we cover certain areas.
Smart benefits, I know everybody recognizes what smart benefits is, but this is just to, again, drive home that the smart trip platform is the platform for our smart benefits. So that upgrade has to be in place first before any of these other features can come online. The smart benefits, of course, the IRS ruling. What I really want to highlight on here is that staff recognizes that our customers for our smart benefits are not just the employers who are allocating these or assigning the commuter benefits, but it is actually our employees who are receiving these benefits. So we recognize that. We try to keep them in mind in everything that we do. Next slide. For smart benefits in 2010, the major piece of this is that there are no changes to this. While this second bullet identifies that we expected the grant, the IRS to grant the extension, we have in fact received that notice on Monday that they did extend it for 1 year. So that's definitely good news. Smart benefits will operate in 2010 the way it does today, which is simply meaning allowing the rollover. So nothing's changed. We're going forward. Customer communications. Throughout September and November, we held various customer communications to inform the smart benefits customers of what the implementation was ensuing. Since then, since we've had the changes that we've communicated to the board and to the public, our employer communications have included various, these are the various areas that we are, the ways we've actually communicated news releases, identifying the delays to the smart benefits and other features, various emails we've sent directly to the program administrators and the employers. We don't have a means right now to communicate directly with the smart benefits recipients. We work through the employers to do that, to communicate. We don't have all their emails, so that's something that we're going to be working on. There's going to be another news release this afternoon or tomorrow, I believe, on the latest information from the IRS that it's been extended, that they've granted the extension. Not listed on here, though, is another item that I was involved with online chat session with Dr. Gridlock last month. So we're collecting and continuing to collect and review customer feedback on the smart benefits changes. Next slide. Parking and transit benefits. Okay. Moving forward, at the encouragement of the IRS when we met with them last month, we are requesting additional information from them regarding the regulations as so that our engineering and technical staff can finalize the approach for smart benefits regarding the changes to allow rollover in accordance with the IRS rules. A revised project schedule is being drafted, but we'll finalize it when the technical approach for the smart benefits piece is determined. In the meantime, though, the next fare upgrade continues. The work has not stopped. We'll give you an update on that in just a few minutes and a little into the presentation. So, the next slide. The good news is we have actually completed the installation of over 200 of our compact point of sale devices. These are the devices where you can add value to your smart trip cards. And that was completed in October. Passes are right now planning. We're looking at that in late spring. I'll get into a little bit more detail in two more slides. I'll just go through the other customer features. The self-service website on the next slide. We're looking at that as a phased rollout to begin in late spring. The development of the features of this particular website feature is underway. We are being extremely cautious with and taking the appropriate action to ensure financial transactions that are going to be viewable are accurate and risk-free, meaning that we take every precaution to ensure the privacy of our card owners' information. We will use best commercial practices to ensure to do this as a model. Right now we're looking at the credit card industry, PayPal, eBay, that sort of thing, so that's what we're looking at. We did look at other agencies' websites for this and checked with them to see what they're doing. We looked at Oyster Card, MARTA, Miami-Dade's website for these features. It'll be phased out. The phase one rollout, though, will begin again, like we said, in late spring. That will include viewing your transactions, card balances, and being able to report lost or stolen cards electronically. Phase two is where we'll look at, go down to the auto load, will be rolled out in summer of 2010. Regarding the passes, there are a total of, well, Metro has a total of 7. Our regional partners have a total of 15 right now. We're testing the pass functionality. I know it says January, but that's actually begun now. But it's still going to take through the period through March to do all the testing on that. We will be coming back to the board, and our staff will be coming back to the board in March to seek approval for a regionally recommended bus pass. Staff will also discuss the regional pass in greater detail at that time, as they are meeting regularly to walk through the details now. Staff will simulate a variety of revenue sharing scenarios, analyze data, you know, the report data, and then recommend an appropriate price for this product when we come back to you in March. Concurrent to the testing of the pass product functionality, the joint regional subcommittees will need to identify the various bus passes from their agencies that they want on the smart trip. But again, this is going to, we'll come back to you. So the functionality will be there, but it's going to depend, before the passes will actually be rolled out, is dependent on what this regional subcommittee recommends as the passes to actually move forward and have on the smart trip card. So where we're at now, we have upgraded the bus system, the fare collection system on the buses. We are in the process of doing that for, and that's actually throughout the region, for our regional partners as well as Metro. We are in the process right now of upgrading the rail system. And right now we have it at 3 stations, Huntington, Eisenhower, and 1 mezzanine right now at King Street. The way this was actually deployed was at, we started off at stations that don't have heavy traffic. We see how it works after we've lab tested it, see how it works in that station, debug anything that has to happen, go to the next station, and then progress as you know, along that way until we get the full system converted. Staff is, actually the entire agency has taken on everybody who has or touches the automatic fare collection system, impacts it or touches it in some way, has been meeting for a couple of months now to develop an agency-wide automatic fare collection strategy. We've met and collaboratively so far identified the vision. We've done a lot of work. I wanted to share with you the vision, though, at this point, and it's to maximize customer convenience by providing an accessible, reliable, and easy-to-use automatic fare collection system. I know that's very high level, but we are looking at those various objectives and goals and developing that, fine-tuning that, and keeping in mind the direction of an open payment system. So that's very much in the forefront as we're looking at this and seeing how we can, what short-term and long-term goals need to be, and decisions that need, tactical decisions that need to be made to have a system that gets us to where we want to go. I'll take any questions.
All right, thank you. There's a lot of news here. For the most part, good news.
Good news.
Perhaps the most immediately relevant and even urgent concerns the delay that has been granted by the IRS that will buy us another year on the changes to smart benefits that had been previously announced. Now, I will tell you that since we initially delayed implementation, the word has not necessarily gotten out evenly everywhere. And it's imperative now that we communicate effectively with employers. I can tell you my own county was moving ahead with plans to, they had an exercise to be able to tell employees what was going to happen, how it was going to affect them. And, as recently as the last few weeks, thought they were going ahead to do that because they hadn't been told it wasn't going to happen. So, if you're the human resource department somewhere and something big is about to happen that affects your employees, until you know it isn't, you've got to be, and I expect that that's true all over the place.
True.
So if there's one thing that has to happen right away, it's an effective communication to people that the bad thing you heard we were going to do, we're not going to be doing. Now, over the next year, making sure that it's not a bad thing in the end, that's, where the work ought to be focused. But right now, people need to know that that thing isn't going to happen. They don't have to worry about it right now. So I hope we'll get that word out. Questions from board members? Mr. Giancola?
Yeah, a couple questions to start off. You talked about the next pair system, next pair five. You didn't give any timelines in all this and when it's going to be totally implemented. I'd like to see something, some discussion now, and then eventually some timelines to at least to monitor this progress. So that's one question. Next question, we've deployed, we now have available at 223 locations the ability to purchase. I mean, how's it working? Are we getting a lot of people using that system?
Yes.
I don't know. And is it worth the effort? And finally, on the IRS thing, while we've been given a year extension, why are we going to wait a year? I mean, you know, it seems like we were rushing to get it done by this January. Not that we weren't doing it prudently and properly, but why do we have to wait a full year to do this? In other words, I don't sense some urgency in any of this. It's just like business as usual.
Well, one of the areas that we wanted, we knew that the customer features were something that were, while we had the IRS, let me back up, while we had the IRS as a looming deadline that we had to meet, we were looking at that primarily and not the rest of the customer features. When I say not the rest, we were looking at those, but we knew that, first of all, the entire upgrade has to happen first of the system. Once that's in place, then we can test these other products, and that one of those being the separation of the smart benefits, parking and transit benefit. Since that is not as impending now, we're still looking at it, but we're now shifting the focus on these other customer features that we've been hearing that you really want out there in the public, and that the public's been telling us we want to autoload, we want to have passes, we want to have you know, this website. So they're still happening. And if it could be sooner, then we certainly will do that. As far as the smart benefits piece of this, but is there anything technically that?
Let me just interject, and I'll tell you this timeline that may help you answer this question. The schedule was originally January 1 to implement the IRS benefits, transit parking benefits separation. The team, the way the program was scheduled, decided that by November 1, we were monitoring this on a daily basis because it's a very complex foundation of the rail network to implement. We had some software issues that were being resolved between IBM and Oracle and Cubic, and that's still ongoing. So by November 1, we had decided that if we could not implement, we would have to then initiate a discussion with the IRS to initiate a request for delay, which happened in the sequence. As you pointed out, Mr. Zimmerman, we may not have communicated it as effectively as we should have. But in November, we did request the deadline. The deadline just received, as of the other day. As a result of that, we intend to still move forward to implement the foundation of the upgrade of the system. That's anticipated now to be done in March, as Cindy had indicated, and only due to the complexity of the software issues that we're trying to debug. So that's the new schedule. As you requested, we will provide the board with a very detailed schedule as we see it today, but that gets updated on a day-to-day, and sometimes actually on a day-to-day basis and on a weekly basis. But we can provide that information to you in detail.
Following up on the transit and parking benefit separation, when we first discussed this after we, the board, heard about this, one of the things we were told was, well, we're stuck. We have to return the benefits to the employers. That's the way the system is being developed. Presumably, in the next year, we're not going to do that. We're going to have some flexibility as to whether or not they're returned and for each individual whether or not they're returned.
I can't answer about individual, but Charlie is on a technical point of view, is that a capability?
We're gonna deploy both types of products, ones that allow rollover and one that don't, so we can customize it.
Does that mean I have to have a different smart card?
No, it would be just like you could have a different pass today. It would be a different transit benefit or parking benefit.
But it'll be part of the software, not part of what I'm carrying.
Correct. Right? Either one could be.
So the software will allow me to be category A or category B.
Correct.
One of the things that I thought was very, very important last time around that we didn't do very well at was letting our customers know very early what this is all about. So not only do we have to tell them now that we're not doing it, but real early we have to start talking to them about the fact that next January we may be doing it. And the reason I say may is I personally believe that the position which was taken by the IRS was not necessarily supported by the legislation that Congress passed. And that, in fact, it may not even be the intent of Congress. And it provides a rather serious burden on employees and employers throughout the country, and in fact, created a serious burden for us. One way to find out what the intent of Congress is to let people know early what they really need to do, not just employers, but employees, in order to deal with this separation of benefits. Because that one of our large benefit areas is Capitol Hill, and they may just notice this and say, gee, this isn't what we intended. If that's the case, it would be nice to know that early, not late.
You're suggesting a congressional fix, maybe.
I'm suggesting that there may not need to be a congressional fix, but people on the Hill may be able to
convulse to an agency
and say, this isn't really what we intended to begin with.
I think what might help that dialogue, and I agree with that assessment, is that the IRS has requested from us to give them a detailed question, which we've actually circulated not just internally but to some of our regional partners, that they can actually answer and send out clarifying answers on their intention of this ruling. And that actually should be sent out in the next month from the IRS.
I think it's still one step short of where I'm talking. I think the IRS, and probably a different set of people at the IRS, came up with this particular view, which may or may not be the intent of Congress. It's not clear to me that the intent of Congress was that if a transit agency charges for parking, that it can't be the same benefit that people get for transit. That distinction was a creation of the IRS. I don't believe it was a creation of the legislation. So I think that early customer information would serve two functions. One is it would, in fact, get people prepared for something that's fairly complicated. And second of all, it would at least alert the people on the Hill that if they didn't think that this was what they were doing, they might want to change it. Another question on the passes. Will these be passes that I can get right at a vendor? In other words, can I take my Smart Trip card, put it at a vendor, and it'll load a pass, or do I have to do this some other way?
The options, you can do the rail passes at the vendor, the bus passes on board the bus. You can use the compact point of sale and eventually autoload them.
So all of those will create a pass? So yes. If I want to switch from one pass to another, I can go to those places and they will switch passes?
Correct.
Can I have more than one pass at a time?
Yes, you can have up to five, actually.
That's very good. On the self-service website, there was some discussion at one point that employers might get access to the smart benefits of employees. Is that still the case?
We have a privacy policy that we're following, and that's how we're designing the system for the auto load. And the privacy policy is if you register your card, you are the only one who can actually see those transactions as a registered user. What we provide to the employer, if an employer requests, we provide that in summary detail. We do not provide specific information and detailed transactions by cardholder.
Okay, I think that's something that probably the board needs to visit to review its policy and decide what it really wants to do relative to that, because that is starting a slippery slope on the privacy issue, and it's one that we need to think through pretty carefully from a policy point of view.
And we can provide that. We are currently looking to design the system so that only the registered user of a card would have the capability of looking at their own transactions. And we're looking to build in protections to the website, because now it's different. When you go to a vending machine, you can load value to your card. But if you're loading value on a website, it has some PII consistencies, as you know, in the industry, PCI compliance. So you have to have a password to log in. You have to prove that you are the card user. And currently, right now, we don't have those protocols in place in our current system.
I understand. I'm just saying that there's a, one of the interesting things about technology is as it gets better and as it expands, it creates a whole series of issues that are broad policy issues, and I think this is one that the board really ought to weigh in on. When I go to auto load, will I be able to specify the source of the load? In other words, will I be able to say, use my smart benefits, and when my smart benefits run out, use this credit card, and after that, use something else?
Yes, you could. It would first look to your smart benefits and then supplement that with your credit card or checking account.
Does it do it automatically, or can I tell it?
Does it automatically.
If I need to override it, is there a way to do it?
You could have a separate auto load or something like that.
Okay, would you think through the different things that different people are going to probably need? We got a year here, actually a little less for some of this.
And that's the interaction between the web access and this other feature that you're talking
right.
about.
Right. I'm trying to make sure that as people use this web access, they don't find there's only one way they can do things. You know, and presumably they can get a pass there and load the pass that way also. Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Layton.
Who's designing the software? I would imagine that these functionalities that you're talking about are model specific.
Yes.
Well, in the case of Cubic is the supplier of the software. They have a core product, and then there's additional custom products that WMATA required.
Right. And the core product is basically Nexpert 4, Nexpert 5.
The version of software is now called Nexpert 5, but it incorporates what the regional agencies got on their buses was Nexpert 4. When they're part of a software maintenance agreement with Metro, when we incorporated new features before we signed the contract, once we got those features, they were eligible to get them as part of the software maintenance agreement, and that's why they've all been upgraded to the newer version.
Are we in the R&D stage of the new functionalities that we're suggesting?
No, we're in the testing and deployment except for the transit benefit part.
Okay, who's paying for that?
It's part of the contract.
Part of the contract.
Yes.
Who owns the license? Is there any licensing agreements or anything related to these new software applications?
Yes, it's a shared license between the region. And part of the software maintenance, regional software maintenance agreement.
What does the licensing agreement allow us to do?
It entitles us to updates and certain hours to make additions to some of the features that we have.
Who is the provider of the devices that we're acquiring for the point of sale changes? Are those off-the-shelf devices, or what are the devices? Where do we purchase them?
They're Verifone devices, which are off-the-shelf, but then they're integrated with the Cubic target for reading the cards and the software.
How much of the specificity with the new passes, I gather you have weekly passes, you're going to have senior citizen passes, and you will have the ability to incorporate those within the new smart cards?
Yes, we can have a tremendous amount of passes if that's what the board and the agencies want to have.
And will those passes be tied into the software to the smart card, or are they? How would they be read? Is it the back office, or is it tied to the front end with the devices itself?
The product, the pass is on the card, so it would read the card.
Once you've prescribed the passes that will be held on that card, would you have any possibility of changing that? Changing the composition and the nature of the passes that are on the card?
As far as how they behave, the rules, things like that? Yes.
And how about the actual passes that will be on the cards? For instance, if the region decides that they want weeklies and senior cards or passes on the card, and the system was set up to accommodate those, would you be able to then also go on and say we want to do a special pass for weekly travel without doing total upgrades and changes?
No, it's all configurable. All the rules are configurable.
Okay. And are there additional charges to have that done?
No.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm not finished. Sorry. I'm not finished. In terms of the functionality of the new system, it would be helpful if we had a timeline that actually laid out each one of the functionalities, and also what's their relationship to one another. What's the relationship between the transit benefit parking to the auto load, what the sequence is, how they relate to one another. It'd be helpful for us to understand that and why a decision was made to go one versus the other, if there's a relationship.
We have that in the schedule. We can provide that.
The other point or question that I had was related to the open payment system and what are the functionalities that we are continuing to purchase in request in this particular sequence, and how does that relate to the eventual thoughts about the open payment system? Is there any relationship?
I'm not sure we can answer that yet, because we're in the process of evaluating the solicitation that we have out there for open payment, which was, as you know, more of a performance-based solicitation. These are the outcomes that we would like. And when we derived those outcomes, we actually derived it with the Next Fare 5 capacity and capabilities in mind. So
we derived that with the Next Fare 5 capabilities in mind.
We knew what we would be having. We knew that we would have the capabilities of Next Fare 5. And when we looked at the solicitation for the open payment, we derived, we said, these are some of the other performance outcomes that we would like to have that we don't currently have now with the Next Fare 5.
Okay. So how does the Next Fare 5 capabilities tie into what the open payment system will provide? And what are you buying in the Next Fare 5 that actually ties into the open payment system?
Well, I like I said, I'm not sure I can answer that right now. I think the open payment was focused more on real flexibility for credit cards, debit cards, and anything you had in your wallet. Whereas, you know, we're limited with the Next Fare 5 just in terms of just the fare media vehicle with the smart trip. But it does have a lot of other capabilities.
Well, it depends on what capabilities you're buying as well. So I'm not sure what that is until I know what the functionality is of what we purchase and how that relates to what we're planning to do. And that's one of the reasons why I'm asking the question. You mentioned early on that there has been there's a AFC strategy that engages other departments that touch this system. What are those other departments, and is there any thoughts of how they change in the reorganization and structure?
Yes. Currently, the departments are the fare collections department resides currently in engineering services under now Mr. Kubitschek. And then there's a fare distribution and media sales, which resides in my area in Treasury. And then there's another distribution of web sales, which resides in communications. And then there's a smart trip office to deal just with this implementation that is within under finance, under my department. However, all of those departments, when the general manager put the smart trip office together 15 months ago, it was matrixed managed to include all of those functions, and that's how they have been working together. Going forward, part of the strategy assessment is to figure out whether or not we should look more centrally, and that's the assessment, as well as some of the strategies that we're looking to deploy. So we are looking at that.
And if I can add, we're also including in the strategy the units, all the other business units. We're talking about marketing, we're talking about bus operations, rail, IT, Metro Access, maintenance group, everybody who has, again, who has an impact or who touches the system.
Yeah, and I apologize. I did not mean to leave out IT. And furthermore, I will say that we did have a solicitation out for the website capability, and we actually withdrew it because Ms. Peck was able to actually internally provide that development of the website. So we are actually doing that internally, which we know is going to save us some money and provide us a little bit more integration and control over that process.
So. Just say my own assessment, there is a tremendous disconnect within the agency for the various components that do touch the Smart Trip program. I think that's one of the reasons that we've had some of the difficulties
implementing and moving forward with some of the programs that we've had, and most recently, our IRS compliance has been an example of that. So I hope that some of that gets dealt with within the reorganization structuring. But the other question that you know concerns me is until you know where you want to go, you can't be real clear about what you're doing and what you're investing. And I'm not sure we still know where we want to go. And I'm concerned about any investments that we're making short term and what impact they may have in terms of your ultimate goal. And if you're making additional investments even now in a fairly proprietary system, and you continue to make more and more investments in that proprietary system, your ability to go to an open system gets constricted, or it becomes a bad investment because you've tied so much. And the more we continue to build and develop down into a system that's proprietary, we continue to get caught more and more into that system. So any movement away from that becomes more costly, more expensive, and also you're more reluctant to make that movement because, once again, you felt that you've made this huge major investment, and no matter whether or not a move away from it would be great, you're not inclined to do so because of the investment that you're making. And we're kind of continually doing that. So I think your AFC strategy needs to be thought out pretty early on so that you're not making poor investments even now. And it's also very important, and I think another problem that we have is our own lack of understanding of what the IRS requirements actually were. And we began to build a system to respond based upon our own lack of information. So I think it's also important for us to step back. I understand that the IRS is going to provide us some information and some guidance. I think it'd be very careful. We should be very, very much aware of what that is before we start building again. And to go back to my colleague from Washington's point early on, I hope we too do not wait until January of 2011 to once again get into a crash course where we have to respond to some changes that are needed. And if there's going to be changes legislatively or within Congress, one that needs to happen earlier, if that's not going to happen, then we need to make sure that we have time to put in a system in place where we test it out, where we check with our customers before we launch it upon them, and make sure that when we get feedback from them, which we probably should have gotten from the outreach sessions that we have, that we try to incorporate that feedback rather than just ignore it as we're going to do this because we need to do it and not try to respond to the changes that it's going to have on our customers ultimately. With that,
Mrs. Hudgens.
I just wanted to go back to the slide in which you were talking about the implementation of the passes, and you have a timetable there. And I guess I'm curious, does this mean that this is the interjurisdictional pieces that will all go in together? And how do you deal with the revenue sharing if not?
That's correct. And the subcommittee that's represented, all the regions are represented on that subcommittee, are coming up with a recommendation that we would provide to the board on the revenue sharing. Currently on paper passes, it's not revenue sharing.
Right.
So we have done some analysis in Treasury, and it's being presented to the committee sometime in the near future so they can look at and come to an agreement on potential revenue sharing and other paper pass protocols that they want to provide. And we will provide that to the board in March for their recommendation.
So that's when we'll be able to determine whether or not, one, we're able to move forward on all of the jurisdictions, or how do we deal with the resolution of the revenue share.
That's correct.
Other questions?
It's hard for me to believe that we still haven't resolved revenue sharing and the issues that relate to that. I hate to say this, but I can go back to 1996 where there's discussions about a regional system And the discussion at the time was the revenue sharing and what needed to happen between Virginia, Maryland, and the District of Columbia related to how that functions with, at that time, the pending Smart Trip program. And for me to hear now that almost 10 years later, more than 10 years later, that's still something that we haven't.
It's the reality.
We actually do revenue sharing with the Smart Trip card today, but we don't have passes on the Smart Trip card. That's why we don't do revenue sharing with passes.
Right, that's correct. The paper passes are very difficult. It's very manually intensive if the driver doesn't hit the button. I mean, but Charlie is correct. The revenue sharing occurs on Smart Trip.
Which means that we've already done the hardest part. I mean, that was the big issue. That's most of the revenue that's involved. So there's this last bit of it, which we haven't had to resolve because we didn't have the technological situation that demanded it. We do now. And, you know, it is important that we get that resolved. Everybody's going to have to work on that across the region. Obviously, there are going to be some compromises. But I hope we don't lose that we are on the verge of some fairly significant improvements for our customers here, that if implemented according to the schedule that's laid out here preliminarily, will mean some real benefit that people will find throughout this coming year. And in a year when there's an awful lot that isn't going to be good, because that's the nature of the year we're in, you know, I think it's important that we do everything we can to improve the experience our customers have. And I am confident that we'll do whatever we have to work out remaining differences among the jurisdictions to get a reasonable compromise. And that the staff will do what's necessary to make sure that they do, in fact, deploy these various features more or less on the schedule that we've seen today.
We are determined to have that success for the board, yes, and the customers.
Good.
Ms. Julie. I have a question. What is the ultimate, what impact does these changes have on our cost of revenue collection?
On our cost of revenue collection?
Yes.
Ultimately, it should go down.
Ultimately, it should. But do we know what our current cost of revenue collection is, and what, and as we have looked forward to change this, is that one of the goals that's also been established in addition to the customer convenience? But have we looked at revenue collection cost reduction as one of the objectives of this as well?
That's definitely part of the strategy, and we actually already implemented actions to include those efficiencies in our revenue collection facility, where we actually have collecting less coins. We actually, as we go through some attrition in that area, we do not replace people. We utilize services of a bank to actually collect those, typical of what other transits do. So we are actually monitoring that and implementing those efficiencies as we get them.
I would like to see the fully allocated revenue cost that will currently occur across the system that relates to fare collection, and what those are, and what are, how we're proceeding along those lines. Because that's operating costs. And, you know, everything that we can do in the system to reduce our operating costs, that's where our capital investment should also be made long term.
And that's the last word. We're due next door. I'm sure the chairman expects us for the full board meeting. This committee is now adjourned. Yes, Mr. Kubitschek.
I apologize, but I'd like to give you just a quick update on Martin Luther King shutdown.
Why don't we have the general manager do that when we're in the board meeting?
Okay.